Doctor Who starts next Saturday on BBC iPlayer.
This is Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The best-selling American writer Daniel Handler is perhaps better known by his pen name Lemony Snicket. Lemony is the cynical narrator of a 13-book saga called A Series of Unfortunate Events. It's the tale of three unlucky orphans, Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire, who are hounded by their guardian, the sinister Count Olaf. The books are a phenomenon, selling more than 70 million copies around the world, along with a film starring Jim Carrey and a series on Netflix. Lemony has published many books for children, and Daniel has also written 7 novels for adults under his own name, as well as a screenplay inspired by Verdi's Rigoletto. He's also a keen accordion player, and has performed with bands including Death Cab for Cutie, The Decemberists, and The Magnetic Fields. Daniel, you describe yourself as an unrepentant classical zealot, and indeed we're going to hear music by Dvorak, Scriabin, and Berlioz. But we begin with Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica.
Yes, this was a piece of music that I listened to just constantly for years during my childhood. I don't know what first attracted me to it. My parents had various classical recordings, but they had this on cassette. I can see it now with an unflattering picture of George Zell, the conductor, on the cover, and I would listen to it over and over and over and over. My parents have a photograph of me in the living room with my ear to the big wooden speaker of the 1970s, trying to listen as carefully as I could to this symphony.
I think it probably spoke to a young would-be Lemony for its drama, because it is a dramatic piece.
It is, yeah. It's a wonderful piece to introduce children to. It's dramatic. It feels like something terrible is going on. I guess Beethoven did think something terrible was going on. I remember I learned at a fairly young age that he dedicated it to Napoleon and then crossed it out. And I thought that was a really fun gesture. By the time I was in high school, I enjoyed writing poems that I would dedicate to some young woman and then cross out when she failed to live up to whatever fantasy I had.
Well, here we are. The Beethoven Eroica.
Thank you.
music from the opening of Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, recorded live in Rome in 2001 when it was conducted by Claudio Abbado. It's extraordinary in that music, the light and the shade, the sudden moving forward and then suddenly taking a step back. And then those repeated childlike tantrum chords.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum.
I mean, how could you not like that as a child? You could go to the piano and play the same note over and over again and just tell your parents you were playing part of the Third Symphony. I just think perhaps because I've just listened to it so many times, all of it feels inevitable. It doesn't feel invented. It feels like something you already knew.
Apart from getting your ear close to the speaker, what was your childhood like? Was there lots of music? It was in San Francisco, wasn't it?
Yes, my parents were both music enthusiasts. They loved it. They met at a performance of the opera, and I grew up with lots and lots of classical music playing. My mother would take our Fisher-Prize toys, these tiny little wooden dolls that we had, and act out the plots of the operas before we went to the free performances.
Oh, that's brilliant. So you knew what was going on.
Well, more or less, yeah. My sister and I still quote her reenactment of the end of Carmen, which is, "You said you'd be my girlfriend." Which, for listeners at home, is not technically how that goes. But it, but it meant that we spent the whole performance waiting for the big stabbing. I think my parents had a real sense that the drama of classical music was a wonderful way in. And I always think it's funny that you can buy collections of classical music for young people and it's always just the timidest stuff. I think, no, 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 it's the one that sounds like Napoleon.
Because children, well, you know better than anybody, but they don't like being spoken down to, do they? And they don't want to be kind of, in quotes, protected. They want to be exposed to the sides of life.
And it's more interesting when something happens.
Did you play an instrument when you were growing up?
I did. I took piano lessons from a very young age with an infinitely patient man. It was a Suzuki method, which is deeply learning by ear. And then I was also in the San Francisco Boys Chorus, which was a very rigorous, more traditional musical education. So I got a lot of theory and hardware and a lot of feeling and emotion and improvisation going on at the same time. It was a lovely way to grow up. And what we're leading to, I believe, for selection number two is a Black Mass Sonata by Scriabin, which was the piece that made me realize that I could not really play the piano that well. That I would be an enthusiast for a living, maybe, but not a pianist. In high school, I was getting a few gigs as a kind of cocktail pianist at receptions or parties, and I was learning that I was good enough to improvise on the same four chords over and over and over again, but that mastering the kind of music that I was preferring then, the kind of spiky spookiness of Scriabin, was beyond my ken.
So instead of you, we're going to have to make do with Vladimir Ashkenazy.
He's pretty good too.
Scriabin's Sonata No. 9, Opus 68, Black Mass, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy. It is tricky. I don't think you should be ashamed, Daniel, for not...
I had definitely bitten off more than I can chew. I was trying to remember why I got it into my head that this would be the thing to play. I can only think that it was too much afternoon viewing of Hammer horror movies where somehow I thought, Black Mass, that sounds good. Let's do that one.
How did you begin to write yourself?
For as long as I can remember, I wanted to be a part of that. I thought writing things down and participating in the world of books was the thing to do. I think it speaks to my complete bonkers narrow vision of that, that I thought, oh, maybe I'll be a classical pianist just to pay the bills, you know, just to go into something regular like music in order to sponsor my literary addiction. I mean, I was, of course, read to when I was a child, but from the moment that I could read myself, I liked to spend a great deal of time stepping into that world.
Were there writers you particularly loved who pointed the way for you in any sense?
I mean, when I was young, I was such a fan of Roald Dahl. I was a fan of Zilpha Keatley Snyder, who I think probably doesn't have much of a visibility in this country. My great aunt Vera was the head children's librarian in Los Angeles, and she would send, when my mother was young and then when I was young, lots and lots of books. And I miss the way that you can read when you're young, when you have no idea what's supposed to be good, terrible. You don't pay any attention to the packaging. Just the constant spelunking in literature like that was the most happy times of my life.
Did you have any success when you were just starting off? Was there something that bolstered your confidence?
No. I was given very meager encouragement by a couple of people, including great love for my wife. But commercially, no one thought I was interesting for a great period of time. Deservedly, I might add, I was still learning my craft and not very good at it for a while. But I couldn't stop.
How did you come by Lemony Snicket?
Well, my first novel under my own name, The Basic Eight, is about a murder in a high school and the hysteria that such a murder creates in the media. As a result, I was writing to various right-wing organizations that like to create such hysteria, and I was on the phone with one of them, and I said, hello, can you send me some of your materials, in parentheses, invisibly, inaudibly, only to me, so I can mock you in a novel? And they said, certainly, what is your name? And I thought, oh, you can't give them your name. And so I just said something immediately that wasn't my name, which was the phrase, Lemony Snicket. And then there was a pause. And during the pause, I thought, out of all the things you could say that wasn't your name, that's what you chose to say? There are many things that you could have said that are a name. You chose this instead. And I thought, no one's dumb enough to think this is a name. And then the right-wing woman said, is that spelled how it sounds? And I said, yes. And then I said, please read it back to me, because I had no idea how it sounded like it was spelled, and I wrote it down. And then some years later, when I started to write mock gothic novels about terrible things happening to orphans, I was in need of a name for my unreliable, despondent, hysterical narrator, and I had this name lying around, which I'd been using kind of prankishly in those years. I loved with my friends to use that name if you had to pick up a pizza at a restaurant just to hear someone say large pepperoni for Lemony Snicket. I had a horrible office job at which I was horrible and used a great deal of time typing up hysterical letters to the editors of tiny newspapers, accusing them of dastardly things. I signed those letters, Lemony Snicket, for my companions during that time in my life. Out of all the people who are surprised at what has happened with Lemony Snicket, they are the most surprised that all that time doing ridiculous things with that name turned out to pay off.
It's a wonderful name for children, I think. Well, and for adults, actually, but there's something about it which is pleasing.
Yeah, they like saying it. It kind of rhymes. It somehow it fits together.
And it has a taste.
Yeah, I've had to taste too many things. So many people have made me things called Lemony Snickets that they bring me beverages and pastries and liqueurs.
The books follow the adventures of the Baudelaire children. They're sort of morality tales, aren't they? Were you drawn to those kind of books as a child?
I was off-put by them as a child. Any book that had a moral, I was suspicious of, because the moral never seemed really to fit. And my father fled Germany in 1939 when he was a child from the Nazis, and I grew up hearing the stories from the surviving members of my extended family, who weren't numerous, stories of their miraculous escapes and stories of people who hadn't made it. And I think that that made a huge impression on me as a child, that your behavior was not the way to control your fate. In fact, perhaps there was no way to control your fate. So I think mock morality tales came out of that kind of fury and bewilderment.
You often warn your readers that what follows might be upsetting or disturbing.
Yes. And
that probably just draws them in even more, doesn't it?
I hope so. I mean, I think it's fun when I hang out with children to say maybe something terrible will happen, then everyone's interest perks up. But also, when the first volume was done, the publisher said to me, we were wondering if you could write something that would kind of entice people to read this on the back. And I thought, what kind of person would want to read this dreadful story? And I took a walk and I had some errands to do, and I went into a pharmacy and I saw all the warnings on the bottles, and I thought, oh, I know what to do. And I remember when I was a child, I would sometimes read the labels on the things and I would think, gosh, I can't wait for some of those things to happen to me. You know, ingestion causes blindness. Let's try that.
But what you home in on, as of course did Roald Dahl, is the sort of darker side of life. Children have a great fascination for that.
I think we all do. I mean, here we are at the BBC. Today's headlines, whatever day you're listening to this, it's not good news. I think we're all interested when something terrible happens in one way or another.
What did you make of the controversy surrounding the Roald Dahl books being rewritten to remove language deemed offensive by the publishers?
Well, I was against it. I mean, I understand that urge. You know, if you're with a child and there's a strange noise in the middle of the night, what you want to say is, that is nothing. And if they see something from a news report, I understand that you want to be protectionist about it. You just can't. And you certainly can't do it by tinkering with Roald Dahl until his words are not offensive. His words are offensive. I mean, he was an offensive person in some ways, and his stories are full of really, really wretched things. That's a wonderful way to learn about wretched things.
The next music, I think, possibly has helped you sometimes in your writing, and maybe even of these books.
Yes. Herald of the Mountains is one of the movements of Herald in Italy by Berlioz. It's a piece for viola, which is an instrument my sister played and which is oft overlooked and oft mocked. But I love the storytelling feel of this entire piece, and it's something that I've listened to over and over and over again to kind of keep myself in the somewhat distant narrative mode that the Snicket books take place in. I think it has a storybook character to it, and it has a slight tinge where something might really go wrong.
Thank you.
You know, there's something so evocative about that music and something so old-fashioned about its tone.
Harold in the Mountains from Harold in Italy, Opus 16 by Berlioz, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra with the viola soloist Tabea Zimmerman, and the conductor was Sir Colin Davis. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the American author Daniel Handler, also known, of course, as Lemony Snicket. A series of unfortunate events was turned into a film starring Jim Carrey, and more recently a Netflix series for which I think you wrote the screenplay, and you were honoured with a Peabody Award. Is it a very different process, do you find, turning things into film?
Oh, incredibly different and difficult. I mean, the luxury of writing on the page is that no one has to go and construct exactly what it is that you've done. So if you say, this takes place in a volcano, no, never mind that. It takes place in an Italian restaurant. No one's canceling a whole bunch of construction orders. And television and film, it's very expensive. Almost all of the Netflix show was filmed on sets that were built in huge warehouses outside of Vancouver. And anyone who's in charge of that kind of money is very nervous. I always think it's like if someone said, will you please take this suitcase with $200 million in it across town? You'd be nervous the whole way. And so, yeah, they're scared. I wrote most of the first season basically myself. And then for the second two seasons, I gathered a small group of really dedicated and terrific writers. They were all playwrights. They were all young playwrights. And I said, I would like them all to come to my house and we'll sit around the dining room table and hash it out that way. And it was just a wonderful way to spend time. It was really fun.
Do you have a particular process? I think you start with a notebook that accompanies you most. Oh, there it is.
I do, yeah. Your listeners will be happy to know that I'm lifting the notebook now. Unless I'm in the shower, I'm always right near pen and paper, and I take a gazillion notes. I put things on index cards. I put things on legal pads, and I try to kind of heap them together. I enjoy writing in cafes and libraries rather than in my home. But on paper is the main thing for me. I'll type it up into the computer eventually, but I don't like to compose on a machine that is also my mailbox and my television and my newscasters and all the things that computers have become. I love the pleasure of ink and paper.
Schoenberg next. And normally when we say that, people get a little bit nervous. But actually, of course...
Stay with us. Stay with us, listeners.
Yeah, because a lot of his music actually stems from quite a romantic idiom.
Yeah.
And even this piece, Transfigured Night, Verklärte Nacht.
Yeah, I think he has an undeserved, difficult reputation. Some of his pieces are difficult, but so much of it is lush and beautiful. And I actually came to this backwards from film music. I love Bernard Herrmann's score for Vertigo, just an astonishing thing. And then I read someplace that he was really influenced by Transfigured Night. So I went back and listened to Transfigured Night, and I felt a little silly. You know, it felt like I had just learned that Paul McCartney was in a band before Wings. But I like hearing that evolution. And this is a beautiful piece. This was also something that I listened to enormously when writing the Lemony Snicket books. And there's something about the romanticism that you can feel the dread right under it. You can feel it isn't giddily romantic. It's wiser romance to it, that things aren't going to go
well. That's
a
German expressionism of the time, isn't
yeah.
it? It's prompted by a poem by Richard Demel.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a soap opera, the poem. It's a conversation between a woman who is pregnant with another man's child and this man, and they reach a point of forgiveness, but it's a fragile forgiveness. It's based on a mutual faith. The music captures the unease in more experienced love, where you think, I'm not giddy. I know everything's not going to be all right. In fact, maybe it's not even all right now, but I'm still lifted by the love in there.
Thank you.
It just has beautiful air of desperation under all the lushness to it. I spend so much of my time thinking about what the right word would be, what the right phrase would be, where can I put this sentence? And then it's really wonderful to go to a place where by its nature, it's inutterable. Mm. We're not going to learn something that Schoenberg said. Even if we read the poem that inspired that, we're not going to get deeper into the music that way. The music comes from listening.
And is there something in the nature of the abstraction of music? In other words, it doesn't spell it out. It's up to you to decide what
it's saying. Yes, I think so. You know, we listened to this piece together. We both felt that romantic desolation. You were weeping openly. I think I was more stoic.
Look, you must get off my Nina.
But we both felt invested in such a way that it didn't tell us to be. We just were anyway. And I think that's the magic of that kind of composition. I think it's just beautiful.
We were listening to the third movement from Schoenberg's Transfigured Night, performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Edward Gardner. You're not frightened of difficult subjects. In We Are the Pirates, the main character, Gwen, volunteers at a home for the elderly where she meets Errol, who has Alzheimer's. They bond over pirate literature. But then this was a condition that very sadly your father suffered from too.
Yeah.
And that must to a certain extent have informed your feelings, seeing him go through that.
Very much so. And I'm grateful that you brought it up because music was such a solace to him. As his mind became inarticulate, it was a space where he could go. It was sometimes painful for his family to see because he wasn't able to say how he was feeling or even to indicate that it was going on. You could just tell that it was a huge solace for him. It was a way to be in a space that didn't require the active mental participation that the rest of life does.
In 2009, with the composer Nathaniel Stuckey, you wrote a piece called The Composer is Dead. I think you better tell us about that.
Yes. Nathaniel was someone I went to high school with. We lost complete track of each other. We almost literally ran into each other on the street, and he'd become a composer. We had talked about working together, but I couldn't think of what I would have to do with classical music except appreciate it. And then I was asked to narrate a performance of Peter and the Wolf, and I had a great fun doing it. But what did occur to me was that Peter and the Wolf is designed to introduce young people to the orchestra. And at that, it's not very good. It's a beautiful piece. But if you don't know what the instruments are, you still don't know when you leave. And so from that, we built this piece, which is basically a murder mystery. The composer has been killed. And each section of the orchestra is interrogated. So I like to say it's like Peter and the Wolf and an episode of Law and Order or Prime Suspect. It scratched my itch to be something of a propagandist for listening to classical music.
You play the accordion, don't you, Daniel?
Are you trying to stir up scandal? It's true, yes. In college, I wanted to be in a band. It was a moment in pop music where no keyboard instruments were particularly welcome in a band. Mm-hmm. And so I bought myself an accordion. So I like to say I'm probably the first person in history who began to play the accordion basically in order to meet women. If you play the accordion, you're probably the best accordion player anybody knows. And so as a result, I've been asked to sit in with various bands who would have no use for me if I played something like guitar. And so I've played pop music and Irish folk music and tangos and klezmer and all kinds of things. It's been a delightful little side venture.
The next piece is by Morton Feldman, an extraordinarily imaginative contemporary composer, called The Viola in My Life. Why did you choose this in particular?
Well, Morton Feldman has written a number of pieces that are far too long to be played on this program. And I first encountered his music. I was invited to go hear the Kronos Quartet play. They often present concerts of carefully curated, lively varieties of music. And we got there and we sat down and they played one piece from beginning to end. It was a Morton Feldman string quartet. It was very long. And it moves at kind of a glacial pace. And I just thought it was astonishing. I'd never heard anything like it before. And I went out and pigged out on Morton Feldman immediately. He writes with this care that somehow manages to be utterly unfussy. I put something he said in a recent book of mine, Poison for Breakfast. When Morton Feldman was asked about his method of composing music by John Cage, he said, "I don't move the notes around." And John Cage said, "Not even a little bit." And Morton Feldman said, "No, not even a little bit." Somehow he puts notes on the page and into the air like he's dropping stones into the water. the miracle of Feldman is that he writes these very quiet pieces, and they're not ambient in any sense of the word.
They're oral sculptures in a way.
Yeah. And when I was first discovering his music, I thought, oh, I'm going to listen to this when I'm working all the time. But I found I couldn't get anything done.
We heard the first movement of The Viola in My Life by Morton Feldman, performed by Marek Konstantinovits, playing the viola, the cicada ensemble, and the Norwegian Radio Orchestra, conducted by Christian Eggen. When you're not actually writing, Daniel Handler, do you have passions other than music that you like to indulge?
I do. I am an open water swimmer. I swam this very morning in the Thames in Oxford, where I am living for a few months. My sister and I started doing it together. We learned that we had both secretly wanted to try, that neither of us had really had the courage to do it. And shortly after my father died, I was swimming laps in a swimming pool for the umpteenth time. And I thought, what are you waiting for? And I got out of the pool. I haven't been back in that pool since. And I love how, particularly in cold water, your mind is forced to let go.
And then when you get home, you rather like to cook.
I do. Particularly after a cold swim. You need a hot meal.
Dvořák next.
Yes. The first time I heard these bagatelles, I don't think I'd ever heard of harmonium before and known it was a harmonium. I assume that in his traipsing among folk music is where he picked it up. And I'm always sentimental about these bagatelles because it was part of my wife and I's early courtship.
Oh.
I would cook for her, and we would listen to Dvorak bagatelles, and now look at us, still married.
She, Lisa Brown's an illustrator.
She is, yes.
You've said in the past that laughter is the secret to your relationship.
We do laugh a lot. We are often having peals of laughter before bed. As we're dropping off to sleep, we'll start to talk of silly things and laugh and laugh and laugh. And I always remember that I was telling this at a dinner party to a friend of mine, another novelist, and she said, you know what I do with my husband in bed is make love. Maybe you should try that.
Well, on that note, Daniel Handler, for that very happy note, Lemony Snicket, thank you very much indeed.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for coming and indulging my passions.
Thank you.
Dvořák's Bagatelle, Opus 47, No. 1, performed by the Vogler Quartet, with Oliver Treindl at the harmonium. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the author Daniel Handler, who's best known by his pen name Lemony Snicket. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the director of the Royal Ballet, Kevin O'Hare. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Palestinian Red Crescent says it's successfully evacuated 31 premature babies from Gaza's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, which has been taken over by Israeli forces in their battle against Hamas. The complex has been described as a death zone by international doctors, who made a brief visit yesterday. Israel has accused Hamas of using the hospital as a base for military operations, which it denies. The Israeli military says three more of its soldiers have been killed in fighting in the Gaza Strip. It brings to 62 the number who've died since the conflict began 6 weeks ago. 15 Palestinians are also reported to have been killed in the latest Israeli attacks on the territory. The Prime Minister of Qatar has said the challenges in reaching a deal on releasing some of the hostages held in Gaza are now very minor. Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said the sticking points in negotiations, which Qatar is mediating, were now logistical. In other news, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt says he won't take any risks when it comes to tax cuts. He's due to set out his plans in the autumn statement on Wednesday, which could be the last one before the next general election. Mr Hunt said the focus would be long-term growth for the economy. Speaking to the BBC, the Chancellor said he would not do anything which fuelled inflation. Polls have opened in the second round of Argentina's presidential election. Voters are choosing between the centrist Sergio Massa and the libertarian Javier Milei. Mr Massa, the current economy minister, is trying to convince Argentines to trust him, despite inflation currently soaring above 100%. Mr Milei is a political outsider who's previously wielded a chainsaw at rallies and speaks of destroying the central bank. A 2.7 magnitude earthquake hit parts of Cornwall overnight. The epicentre was in the Mounts Bay area. Some people said it felt like an explosion or an avalanche. The quake was recorded by the British Geological Survey, which has described it as quite small by global standards. At the Cricket World Cup, the host India have set a target of 241 runs for Australia in the final. The match is being played at the world's largest cricket ground, Narendra Modi Stadium in Ahmedabad. And the weather, mild but cloudy with showers or longer spells of rain, though the showers will become more isolated and scattered during the afternoon. South Wales and the south coast of England will be very windy. BBC News and weather, it's 2 minutes past one.
It's an in-depth showcase of the best cutting-edge new music from the UK and worldwide.
The New Music Show on BBC Radio 3.
Join us for highlights of the Ivors Classical Awards 2023.
Just search New Music Show on BBC Sounds.